Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12, and you'll also receive a complimentary 6 months of digital access to The Telegraph for free.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. Matt Hancock set a target previously of 100,000 tests. He met it, but now it seems that he's going to have to increase that very quickly to meet demand, because at the moment he's not. James, we're hearing lots of reports of the fact that individuals, particularly in areas which are thought to have high infection levels, so Bolton and others, are trying to get tests and being told there is not capacity. We've also had Lindsay Hoyle, the House of Commons Speaker, take to social media to complain that members of the state are struggling to get tests. Are we seeing a meltdown of the testing system?
So the problem for the government is that the demand for testing is shooting up and capacity can't keep up with it. And the issue is its capacity in the labs. So they actually have, apparently if you go to these testing sites, they're not particularly busy right now, because the problem isn't about the number of people who can take swabs, it's the number of people who can take this information through the labs, a problem that has been compounded by the fact that with universities returning, lots of the people who were working in these labs have now gone. I think this is actually one of these issues in which the government is particularly vulnerable to criticism, because as with the A-level results, this is something where the Scottish experience offered a preview of what was going to happen. Scottish schools went back and suddenly Scotland didn't have enough testing capacity, and there were cases of people in Glasgow being recommended going to Northern Ireland or Carlisle for testing. The same thing is happening here. One in five people in England work in a school or university or attend school or university. So obviously when all these people go back, especially as these people probably have not got the same level of immunity they normally would have had because people have not been seeing and mingling as much as they normally do, the demand for testing is going to shoot up. I was struck on my way in this morning at the kind of mismatch in the government's messaging issue, because in the summer the kind of message was get a test. Please, everyone, go and get a test if you need one. Because their worry was that they had lots of spare capacity. They didn't think enough people were getting tested. They weren't using it all. Now, I think it is quite clear that we are heading back towards a place of rationing of tests, because they're sending large numbers of tests to hospitals and care homes for obvious reasons, and that reduces their amount of capacity to test the general population. I think this is going to become a very, very big political issue, because if you can't get tested, you can't go back to school or your workplace. And another problem is, if teachers can't get tested, they're not going to be able to teach their class. Now, as I know I sound like a broken record on this podcast, but the really worrying thing for the government is that today is the 15th of September. If this is the problem now, how bad is it going to be in late November, that time when, you know, when everyone normally has a sniffle of the sort that makes them think they need to get tested? I mean, the other problem is, again, this makes logical sense, but whole households going to get tested. So a kid comes back with a cough from school, everyone in the household gets tested. All of this is reducing the capacity. If the government cannot increase the capacity very rapidly, I think they're going to have a massive political problem on their hands.
Fraser, we're beginning to see early signs of life back in the city. The tubes are a little bit busier. You can see queues about two or three now in shops around the Westminster area. Do you think the testing shortage we're looking at means that a lot of this is just going to be stopped dead in its tracks?
I do think there is a massive mixed messages here. I think, to be honest, what's going to stop the recovery dead in its tracks is the Prime Minister's change in advice last week, when he said he now thinks there's a second wave on the way, so it's time to be cautious. The government intends to send a sort of shiver down the national spine, because it believes that changes of behaviour can be more profound in their effect on the virus than, for example, stopping parties of seven or eight. And if you actually look at you're right, Katie, here in Westminster, it was the queue for Pret a Manger was out the door today, I can report. But outside SW1, it's pretty depressing. Every day we see the London Underground tube figures, and we're still looking at a service running two-thirds below its peak. London has been particularly badly hit compared to other cities. But I'm also noticing, I'm the father of three kids, and my WhatsApp parents groups are absolutely chock full of people saying, their kid has got a sniffle, they're trying to get a test, they can't get a test anywhere, does anybody know anything? And so the hunt goes out, well, maybe you can get a test if you go to Swindon, maybe you can like drive 100 miles and go somewhere else, maybe you can go private, maybe there's a doctor around the corner who's got something unofficial. So already you can see this spread virus-like throughout the country. I mean, nowadays, that's how it works. I imagine the vast majority of parents have got a WhatsApp group. And this simply was always going to be the case. As James says, it was inevitable as night following day that when the schools go back, parents are going to be worrying about tests. The other complication for the government is that the Prime Minister has, I think I'm right in saying this, formally committed the country to doing 500,000 tests a day by the end of next month. 500,000. Now, right now, they are struggling to do much more than 120,000. They say technically they've got the capacity for 300,000, but they can't get processed in the labs. Now, it could well be that he triumphs and hits this target, but if he doesn't, then he's going to have the double whammy of huge discontent in the country, which, as James says, is now starting to catch colds again, and also being seen yet again to have been unable to be as good as his word.
And just on that phrase, Matt Hancock today speaking in the chamber made the suggestion, again, one that he has made previously, that actually part of the reason that demand is higher than the number of tests currently available is that people are seeking tests when they don't really need to. Do you think that's going to wash?
Well, this is the same Matt Hancock who was telling us to, if in doubt, get a test only a few weeks ago. So yet again, the government's changing its advice and people really don't know what to think. And also, I mean, right now, the general message from the government is, OK, we've got the testing thing sorted, so we do encourage you to be safe, be responsible, get a test. Right now,
I mean, the government advertising posters, you see, get tested, get back to the things we love.
Yeah, and in fact, Matt Hancock's advice is now, actually, don't get tested. You think he's going to go around graffitiing these posters with the word don't in front of them, or only if really necessary? I mean, how are you supposed to really know? Now, of course, the situation is going to be difficult, but I think this comes down to the government's problem of constantly managing to make promises that it can't deliver. And this is unfortunately becoming a theme of this particular government.
I think there's also it's just a difficult thing on the messaging front, which is, in the summer, the message was, if in doubt, get tested, as Fraser said. Even now, as the government is trying to urge people to be more cautious about testing, and I know this is a separate issue, but I think people hear it in the same way. There is Boris Johnson talking about whole population testing, and you know how that would mean that someone who got a normal test would be able to go back to life as before. And I think the danger is that people jumble up the messages, understandably. And so people think, oh, if I get a test and it's negative, then I can get back to living life as I used to live life.
Now, over to Brexit, James. Last night we had the second reading of the Internal Market Bill. And in the build-up, following Geoffrey Cox's intervention saying that he could not support the government's decision to break international law in the way they had presented it, there was lots of chatter over the number of rebels. There was an effort in Number 10 and by ministers to call round wavering MPs. In the end, what did the rebellion look like?
The rebellion was very small. Only 2 Tory MPs voted against. There were 30 abstentions, but not all of those were kind of active abstentions, if you see what I mean. Some people, like Theresa May, Warren Holiday, or like Graham Brady, the chair of the 1922 committee, they're chairing a part of the bill later on, so they have to stay neutral. I also don't think anyone was expecting last night to be a big rebellion, because last night was a vote on the principle of the bill. The principle of the bill is, should the UK have legislation to underpin its internal market? I don't think that's controversial. I think the interesting question is what happens on this Bob Neil amendment. Now, this is not a government that is naturally backs down. But I did think you saw some interesting signs of movement last night. You know, Boris Johnson emphasising that you'd have to have a statutory instrument passed for these measures, not for these measures to take effect, but within 40 days if they were to continue to be legal.
Did you see that as a climb down, James? When he did that, I couldn't work out. Is this the government basically having to say, OK, we're going to lose this bill unless we make a concession, so here's the concession?
It was a decision to emphasise something that was the case before that they weren't previously choosing to emphasise. I mean, it was an attempt to reassure by pointing something that would already have to happen. And then I thought the other interesting thing was that Michael Gove, in his wrapping up for the government, said that, you know, Bob Neil has a point. And then in answer to Tom Tugendhat, he said that, you know, these powers would only be used if all kind of negotiating avenues had been exhausted.
He was really conciliatory, wasn't he, Michael? I was struggling. He stood up and he basically starts by praising Rachel Reeves, her counterpart. And I wonder to myself, is this the government thinking we made a massive mistake in the confrontation, the way we approached this bill? So it's trying now. I don't know.
I mean, I think Katie has some more on this coming later. But I think one of the things is, I mean, the government, there is a recognition in government that by starting it off with this declaration that they were planning to break international law in a specific and limited way, they have caused themselves a massive problem. So I think you had Lord Keane, the Advocate General for Scotland, giving evidence to a House of Lords Select Committee today, government representative, and he was kind of stressing, you know, again, very different tone from the Brandon Lewis tone. I mean, there is a recognition that the boldness of Brandon Lewis's declaration, which was a government's group, this wasn't Brandon Lewis going off piste, was a mistake, and that they now need to emphasise, as Boris Johnson in his speech, that these are kind of reserve powers that they hope never to use. Now, I think we wait and see. I think the big question is whether there is enough progress on Brexit between now and kind of mid-October, as this bill is still ping-ponging around between the Commons and the Lords, for everyone to say, OK, right, these clauses are OTOs because the EU has listed the UK as a third country for SBS, or the EU has accepted that it can't use the Northern Ireland state aid provisions as an attempt to reach back into the UK, you know, beyond the kind of reasonable measures of particular support for Northern Irish businesses and the like. So I think this is the question, but I think the government are definitely adopting a much more conciliatory tone than their initial bold declaration.
And Fraser, finally, last night we also saw the return of Ed Miliband stepping in for Keir Starmer, who is self-isolating after a member of his family came down with potential coronavirus symptoms. He's received a lot of praise and appeared to be enjoying himself, as he pointed out to Boris Johnson how Boris Johnson had managed to unite all his predecessors in the role of Prime Minister. Here's what he had to say.
The Prime Minister has said many times he wants to bring unity to the country during his premiership. I therefore congratulate him on having in just one short year united his five predecessors. Unfortunately, their point of agreement is that he is trashing the reputation of this country and trashing the reputation of his office.
Do you think it was an effective performance, Fraser, from Ed Miliband? Did it make people think what could have been?
It was a good speech, but it wasn't a very difficult point to make. I mean, the government had got this completely wrong and pretty much admitted it had got it wrong. I was struck not so much by Ed Miliband's eloquence. People said it was the best speech he'd ever given, which might be true, but it wasn't exactly a Robin Cook-style rapier wit forensic investigation. This was simply being able to point out the massive errors the government had made. What struck me was seeing Boris Johnson on the other side of the chamber looking like he was basically being telt, as we Scots say, by Ed Miliband. And I thought to myself, that shows you the kind of week the government's had, unforced errors leading to the embarrassing situation where Boris Johnson is being given the shellacking by Ed Miliband. And he looked very much as if the man who was the loser, and Ed Miliband looked like the victor in that particular debate.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening. And while we have you here, just in case you have not seen it yet, we have recently launched Spectator TV, where Andrew Neil chairs a panel as he looks through the week's events. We have another episode this Thursday at 6 p.m. To register, just go to www.spectator.co.uk/TV. You can also find all the episodes that have been, that's two episodes, on YouTube.